going to get started. I'm going to go a little bit quicker for the second half, just because I have a lot of content. And so I'm going to defer some of the questions till the very end. Although, a really urgent question to ask along the way. So we built kind of a basic app. We've talked about controls, talked about views, talked about view models, a bunch of the basics. Let's start making it a little bit richer and go a couple steps further. First thing I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about URL structures. So right now we're using kind of this pattern of controller slash action, and then parameters get passed as either query string or form post parameters on the URL. Someone was asking earlier, hey, can you override that? Can you change it, etc.? You can. One of the nice things about MVC is it uses the routing rule engine that we added in .NET 3.5 SP1, so that you can basically publish and expose any type of URL structure you want in a pretty easy way. And ASP.NET Web Forms 4.0, which will ship as part of .NET 4, will support the same engine as well. So let's take a look at that in action here. So let's work first on this browse URL. So right now it's product/browse ?category=beverages. What we might want to do is say, let's get rid of the category segment and just make it browse/beverages. And so it looks like it's part of the logical URL sequence when we run it. A couple reasons to do this. One is it looks sexier and there's some aesthetic there. It also potentially can help you with SEO. It's often, SEO rules change from week to week. So whether it helps or hurts, I don't know, but it looks cool. So we're going to do it. That probably does help a little bit. So to change that URL, we're going to go to our global.sax file, which has our application start event. And one of the things you'll notice with an MVC project is it also has this method called register routes. This gets called on app startup, and it's basically where you register all your routing rules for the application. By default, we have a default routing rule, which is where that controller/action, and then you'll notice a little bit later on when we talk about IDs, where that URL routing rule gets created. If you want to have actions before controllers, just change the rule in the way it'll work. The third parameter here is a set of default values. So in this case here, it's saying, if there's no controller specified, use home as the method. If there's no action method, specified, use index as the action method to look at. If no ID parameter specified, pass an empty string. Again, if you want different defaults, just change those values. So for my product controller method here, so for this URL, we're going to go to our global.sax and create a new routing rule that we can use. And so we're going to say routes.mapRoute. We're going to call this product browse. Use any string you want. We're going to basically say the URL format we're going to look for looks like this, except instead of hard coding beverages, we're going to instead add a category token that we're going to pass as a parameter. And I'm going to say when this happens, go to the controller called products. And invoke the browse method, and if no category value is specified, just make it blank. Okay. Compile, and now when we go back here, notice by default we're going to do a new source right now. This, I haven't hit refresh yet. We have the products category equals. Refresh again. Oh, blew up. I don't want to do that. And you hit refresh again. One of the things you'll notice when you use source is my URLs have all automatically been updated, so instead of now it's browse/condom, it's browse/beverages. And you might ask, how in the world did this happen that way? It's basically because routing rules are used both for mapping in URLs in as well as generating URLs out. And so if you remember on that index page, I used the helper function or helper method called ActionLink. This will actually use the routing rule engine to generate the URL. And it said, oh, I'm going to that products browse method. The routing rule I should actually generate maps to this instead of the default one that we had before. And now when I go ahead and click those links, product/browse/beverages, and product/browse.condiments maps to this browse method right here. You'll notice I didn't have to change any code here. I didn't have to change any code anywhere inside my view or my controller. I was able just to create a routing rule at the global.sax level. It affected everything within the app. So it ends up being super powerful, super flexible in terms of rewriting your URLs. Actually, this is not really rewriting your URLs. There is a URL rewriter in IIS now. This is really about mapping URLs, and so you're not actually moving it from one format to the other. The nice thing as a developer, you can have any number of routing rules you want, and they can look however you want, and that's actually just how your app actually works. Good question, yeah?
How would you localize your
URLs? So the question is, how would you localize your URLs? Good question. There's one approach you can take is if you wanted to actually embed a language, you could actually say something like language, like that, and then have a default language there. So you can say like EN/products or FR/products. A lot of it depends on how much do you want to actually localize your URLs, how important that is, versus getting localized content, which is important. But you could probably do a variety of different techniques if you wanted to do that. The way the routing rule system works is we actually look at the routes in the order they're specified. And so this route rule takes precedence over this route rule because this is done first. And so when we try to map a route, we basically start at the top, go all the way to the bottom. The first route that matches is the one we use. And so because this is before this one, that's why we're using it. If we flip the order, because this one works with every URL, this one would take priority.
Very quick question. I noticed spaces got included for percentage sign training. Is there any way to make that be a plus? It's quite annoying. From SEO point of view, plus is much better than percentage sign training.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You mean for
that page?
Yeah, so right now I have like green slash serial.
There's a space in the.
Yeah, I think you can override that if you want to.
That is possible, yeah. Because it's from an SEO point of view, I think plus is
Yeah, that's a good question. The first person has asked me that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can override it. I'm not exactly sure, but maybe we should change the default. I don't know. Yeah. So, we've started to work on our products controller. Right now in our products controller, we're actually putting link to SQL code directly within our action methods. This certainly works, and it's easy for a lot of small apps. As we start building more logic, though, and more controllers in our app, one of the things we'll end up finding is we'll end up repeating our link queries probably in multiple places. And it also can make it a little bit harder to test, because I'm building in a notion of, I'm directly talking to my database through link to SQL, directly within my controller. So one thing that can help as you build larger MVC apps is to introduce a concept we call kind of a service layer, which kind of sits between your controllers and your underlying data implementation code. Service layer does not mean a web service, it just means class. You don't have to do this, but actually you will find a little bit later on it will help with testing. And so to do that, this solution is pretty easy. I'll just stick this in my models folder. I'm just going to say add new item. Let's take a class here. I'm going to call this Northwind service. Let's create a class. Interest of time. Reach into our toolbox here. Let's stick it. And all I'm doing is basically just adding, so it's encapsulating my data context for link to SQL. I'm just adding some helper methods that we can use. So all categories, all products, find products in category, get product, add, delete, and save. So a fairly simple way, just sort of encapsulating my link to SQL code. I can then go back to my controller. I can change this from being Northwind data context to instead of being Northwind service. And instead of saying .categories add to list, I can just say Northwind.all categories. And I'll just change this. So instead of having a link query directly, I'll just say Northwind.find products in category, category like that. So I haven't changed any of the behavior of the app. I'm simply taking my data code out of my controller, putting it in this service layer, and having a controller call that. Any questions on that?
Scott, can you IOC in your service?
Can you use IOC? Yeah, so when I talk about, so one of the reasons I did this, and I'm not explaining all the reasons why I'm doing it yet, but when I talk about unit testing, is when it comes time to test this, this controller, right now I'm going directly against the database. We'll talk about dependency injection a little bit, where I can actually, instead of using the Northwind service that goes against the database, I'll actually implement a fake Northwind service that does an in-memory implementation, so I don't have to hit the database when I do testing. You can use what's called an IOC, or inversion of control container, with MVC, and you can do that for both to swap in the Northwind service as well as to swap in implementation of the Northwind service required. So yes. If you have no idea what I just talked about, don't worry, we'll talk about it later. So I got a service layer involved here. Continuing along, let's now take advantage of the service layer to implement CRUD support within our application. CRUD stands for create, read, update, and delete. And you know, you can think of it as sort of simple forms over data style UI that is going to implement data entry for your application. Within MVC, I can build a new controller. So I could add this CRUD support either to my existing products controller, or I can choose to say add new controller, and let's create a new admin controller that will encapsulate all my kind of standard data entry on top of my products, instead just have products controller be for browsing. You'll notice that there's a checkbox here called add action methods for create, update, delete. I can choose to select that. And when I hit add, instead of just creating an index method, we'll automatically create for you methods for details, create, edit, and delete as well within the controller class. So basically just giving you kind of a stub implementation for what you can, so you can do some CRUD operations. So let's implement, let's do some CRUD stuff. So I'm going to say Northwind service. I'm going to have my admin URL here. Instead of listing categories, let's list all the products. So we'll say bar products is equal to Northwind.all products to list. And we'll pass that to view. I'm lazy, so I'm going to use this feature called scaffolding. So I'm going to say when I generate my view, I want it to be based on products, but instead of being empty, let's create a list. This will reflect over the type that we passed it, and so we need this to say all products. And it's looked and said, oh, you're passing me a list of products, so I'm going to create a table for all the properties in the object that you passed. Now, I can get rid of some of these properties, so I don't really want to expose some of these things. We don't need that. We don't need units on order. Level, no. We'll keep those five core properties. I can go in here. I can get rid of things. What's cool is because we're using .NET Reflection, this will work with any data store data format. So it works with Hibernate, works with Subsonic, works with any data access technology. And now, if I go back to my site, instead of saying /products, I can now say /admin. And voila, I got a, I forgot some table here. One second. What did I forget? Oh, viewer level, thank you. You basically now have a simple table that's listing all my products generated for me in terms of UI. If I wanted to, I could change this to be category.category name. And that show up as well. So sort of simple product listing here. We're going to come back a little bit later and add paging support since this is quite long, but we'll do that after a bit. Let's implement the other support first. So let's go to our details implementation. So this is going to be a details URL that when I click this link, will take me to admin /details/ID. By default, this third parameter in MVC is called ID, unless you change the routing rule. So that's why 5 gets mapped to this ID parameter here. I can say var products is equal to northwind.getProducts ID. We'll then pass the product to here. We'll say add view. We'll scaffold a details view based on a product. Get some of these things going. And now when I click on chai details, you'll see I get taken to the details action method, which displays the details form. Or details view. Make sense? I can change that however I want. Let's go implement the edit support. To that, I'll go down here and let's do the same thing. Copy and paste that. So when it comes time to implement editing support, I'm going to have an edit URL called admin/edit with a number. This is going to implement the Git version of my form post, because I'm going to make edits going to be form entry elements. So when I go to my view, I'm going to say edit, product, edit. Generates a form for me. Now when I click edit, you'll see I have an editable form. Now the way this form is going to work is we look at these helper methods inside of this thing. I'm using a couple of helper methods, the validation stuff, which we'll look at in a little bit. There's also this HTML.begin form helper method, which I'm using to surround this stuff. That's going to generate a form HTML form element with an action. We go view source here. Let's see this in action. But you can see here what this is generating is an HTML form tag. Which by default will post to the same URL that the HTML was generated at. So in this case here, admin/edit/1. You're familiar with web forms, you're thinking, where's the unclick event? How does the button post back? Basically what we've done is we've used this form helper to say, explicitly I want to post to this URL. Again, by default, it's the default one. And all I'm doing is I'm just putting in standard HTML input elements inside this form. And then at the very bottom of the form, I have a input type equals submit element. And what will happen is when someone clicks that button, the form that it is within will cause a post to whatever that action attribute URL was set to. So this is kind of classic HTTP HTML form posts. WebForms abstracts that with the whole postback mechanism. With MVC, you're instead reaching down and you're kind of working directly with that kind of raw support. If I want to actually handle that post within my app, I could do one of two things. One is I could actually put an if statement within my edit method to say if this is in response to a get or if this is in response to a post, do certain different things. Alternatively, we have a way that you can actually overload action methods based on HTTP verb. And so what we're doing here is we're actually going to say, this is the get version of this URL, and this is what the post implementation looks like. And so I'm simply saying this is for a post. By default, if you don't specify it, it's for everything else. And what I'm going to do inside here is, inside my post implementation, I'm going to retrieve the product that we want to edit. I'm going to put my update logic inside this try block. And there's a helper method in HTML/MVC called update model. And I'm going to say update the product we just retrieved from the database. What this will do is it'll look at the incoming form post values and take that complex object and map any of the incoming form post values to the properties on it. So a product has a product name property or a unit price property. We'll look at the incoming HTTP post for the unit price property and set it on the object. And then what I can do is I can just say northwind.save, and that'll persist any changes to that product object back to the database. And then I'm just going to return, do a redirect to redisplay all the products again. And if there's an error, I'm just going to redisplay the product back to the user. What that means now is I can say chai updated. That was previous, in case you're wondering. No, I don't actually print chai or flood. Something about weird people in Arizona. But I did save. And you'll see now, I posted back to the server. The updated value was mapped using update model. It was successfully persisted in the database. We did a redirect back, and I could say chai updated. Make sense? If I wanted to, I'd go back and I could say edit running. And say, so that's kind of the workflow when you want to do get and posts. Basically, you have a get method that displays the initial state, do a post back, do the post method, apply the changes, and do a redirect.
That's about security, find the success if somebody could put non-updated things into the submit
form. Yeah, well, there's two elements to security thing. One is, right now, everyone can hit this URL and change any values in our product database, which we don't want to allow to do. So we'll look at that in a little bit in terms of how you secure that. The other thing you want to be aware of is this update model method is really powerful, but by default, it's going to let you post update everything in the object. Alternatively, what you can do is there's a parameter list here where one of the overloaded versions allows you to specify the included properties you want to support. And so typically, it's the best practice either to specify that here, or what you can do on your product object is actually put an attribute to say what is bindable. And that's typically what I recommend doing, because that way you're not having to duplicate it multiple places. And then we'll only go ahead and update those properties that are allowed to be updated. In my during dinner tutorial that I referenced at the beginning and I'll point to at the end, shows you how to do that. Last but not least, let's implement our create implementation here. Here I'm going to create, instead of actually retrieving a product, I'm going to actually just create a blank new product object and say view product. And then I'm going to go ahead and create a new view. We'll create, that's based on my product. And I want people to set the product ID, so I'll get rid of that. And now if I scroll away at the bottom here and hit create new, you'll see I have a create method being displayed here. The create method is going to post back to the create action. Here, instead of what I'll do is, someone has asked me earlier, can you pass complex objects? Let's actually pass a product object to this method and call it product to create. So ASP.NBC will automatically say, oh, you're getting a product object as a parameter. Let me look inside the form post, create the product, populate it with data, and then pass it to the action method. So it's an example of a complex data type being passed in. And what I can do here is I'm just going to say northwind.add product to create, northwind.save. That was successful. We redirect back to the list. Otherwise, we'll redisplay the product to create if there's any validation errors, which we'll look at in a second.
Scott, if you pass it in as an argument like that, does it use the same bindable attributes?
Yeah. So the question is, if you create a complex type like that, does it use the same include properties, same bindable stuff? The absolute answer is absolutely yes. And now if I want to create something, I can say Reading is cool. Three, false, return, and somewhere here is Reading School, which is created by the database. So basic CRUD stuff implemented now within my app. A couple issues here real quick. Gosh, there's a lot of lists here. Let's make it a little bit shorter. Notice right now I'm getting all the products from my Northwind database. Talked a little bit earlier about iQueryable, so I'm going to quickly... If we go to the implementation of Northwind service, you'll see here that all products is returning back an iQueryable type product sequence. iQueryable is a feature we added in .NET 3.5. Basically what it means is it's a list that is not actually instantiated until you first do something with it. And one of the things that lets you do is actually construct kind of chain operations on top of that. And so you can push, defer effectively work until you absolutely need to have it happen. Put another way, let's make it practical. What I could do is to say, instead of saying get all the products, I can go to my admin controller here and say, let's have an optional page attribute, which indicates I want to do paging on top of my app. And I could then say in page size is equal to 15. And I could say start index is equal to, and what I could do is I basically say page or zero if nothing is being specified. And I can say, let's multiply that by page size. Right? And so in other words, if I say page of 0, it's going to start with product 0. If I say page of 1, it'll say, oh, okay, 1 times page size, it'll start with product 15. That makes sense. And so now I can basically say slash admin, question mark, page equals 1, 2, 3, etc. in order to do paging. What I can then do is change this, so instead of saying giving back the list of everything, I can say skip by a start index and take only the page size of data back. And now, when I hit refresh, it's going to return back only 15 rows. And I can then say admin question mark page equals 2, 3, etc. in order to actually page over my data. And what's nice is it's actually doing all of the paging in the database. Because it's not queryable, only once I actually access that data is it going to go against the database. And it's chained the skip and take operator, so that SQL is going to do the paging for me instead of actually returning all million rows to my web server.
Yeah.
Skip and take together is such a common operation. Is it not, can you have that as an extension method in Link?
You can actually create your own extension method. The question is, why not have a single operator? That's probably a cool idea to have one. I'll pass it to Anders. that's sort of a simple example of paging. But that kind of concept of sequencing and deferring stuff ends up being pretty powerful. It's not just useful in MVC apps, you can also use it with all other types of .NET apps as well. So right now we added some CRUD stuff, we're doing some form entry. A couple things you might be asking though is, okay, those basic data entry, how do I add validation into the mix? And where does it belong inside my app? One of the things a couple things. So one of the ideas behind MVC is, or one concept that we often talk about with MVC is this notion of skinny controllers and fat models. As the idea there is, your controller logic should be as sort of lightweight as possible. So in other words, if you have a controller method that has 100 lines of code, chances are that's too big. You put too much logic into your controller. Instead, what you want to do is have it be a couple lines of code. I typically think of somewhere under 15 lines of code being a good benchmark for a controller, usually under 10 ideally. And if you actually want to put things like validation, things like that, you actually put it in your model layer instead. The benefit of that is it means that any controller or any controller action that wants to take advantage of that validation, if you put it in the model layer, it'll just apply to all of them. So you're not duplicating logic, and you're kind of keeping your validation close to your actual model, which is really where it belongs from a logical perspective within your app. So let's see an example of what that means. So specifically, what I want to do is when I go and edit something, let's go back to the beginning of our data so it's easy to find. So let's go and edit Chai. Let's say, let's take the scenario, if I just empty this out and hit enter, you'll notice that I was able to successfully apply the change to the database. And it's not empty. There's a couple reasons why I could do this. One is Northwind's a terrible database, and it has every field in the world marked as nullable. That's actually the main reason why I allowed it. So it wasn't actually technically an invalid thing to do from either a SQL or linked to SQL perspective, because someone in the database actually marked the field as nullable. You might, when you're building an app, often run into this case where some guy in your company 4 years ago forgot to mark it as nullable, and there's now a whole bunch of code that we need to change that changed it. But I wonder when I'm building my form app, I want to make sure that the stupid administrator can't actually just publish a product that has no name. So this is a good example where I want to add some validation at my model layer that exists above and beyond what's in my database. And I want to have my UI pick up those model changes, that validation change. So, again, we're not going to add that validation in the controller. Instead, we're going to add it at the model layer. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to say add new item inside my models folder, and I'm going to add a class called product. I'm going to mark this as a partial class. And the reason I'm doing this is because when I use Link to SQL in that designer, it created a product class for me automatically. By marking as partial, I can actually add additional members to that product class that the Link to SQL designer generated. This is true for all types of things, including web form, code behind, things like that. What I'm then going to do is I'm going to add validation logic to this product class. You can use a variety of different validation approaches with ASP.NET MVC. We're actually adding a nice declarative model in ASP.NET MVC 2 that uses the data annotation stuff that dynamic data in ASP.NET uses. In this case here, though, I'm actually just going to use another feature that's built in called IDataError.info, which is in the system.componentModel namespace, and which basically has two properties on it that you implement when you want to implement validation. One benefit of IDEA airframe is it's supported by wind farms, it's supported by WPF, it'll be supported by Silverlight in the future. So you can build a class once and have all types of UI binding automatically take advantage of. The error property I can use, I'm just going to say right now, return an empty string. Basically, you can use to sort of indicate a global-wide error on a product object. And then this property gets called by HTML-NDC when it's doing binding for every property that it went ahead and bound. And what it does is it basically passes in the property name, and then you return whether there's an error for the current value. So, for example, I could, in my get, I could say if column name equals equals product name. And say, and string dot is null or empty, this dot product name. And I can say return name cannot be empty. Likewise, if I wanted to, I could say, let's change this to be unit price. And I could say, if unit price is equal to zero. Can't give this stuff away. And then I'll just say, if it's not one of those properties, we'll just return an empty string, which indicates there's no problem with that particular column. Once I make this change, you'll notice now when I go to edit something, if I leave this blank and hit enter, HTML-NDC will automatically flag this as an error and display the name cannot be empty string that we wrote inside that IDEA array info. That's basically because the binder logic inside HTML-NDC will automatically, every time you try to set it, call that IDEA array info and return basically an error depending on whether it is. If I try to make the product free, I get an error of that as well. And I can then fix this. And there you go.
Scott, I'll answer this perhaps, but is there any way, you were talking earlier about jQuery validators at the client side, is there any way of defining a validation rule that applies inside the model, but also applies in the client side so you don't have to spend a round trip?
Yeah. So the question was, so the question here is there a way to have this thing apply in the client side as well? Today you have to write code to do it. I'll give you a quick hint or a quick preview of what it will look like based on NDC2. And NDC2 will actually allow you to define properties. So like you can just say public string product name get set. So this would imagine this wasn't there. And then basically with NDC2 you can actually just say like required. And so it's declarative. And we use it both for validation, and then we'll also have automatic jQuery Ajax generation. And so we can use the attributes to infer client-side scripts as well for validation. So that's coming in the near future. For right now, I'm just going to use the IDEA or info. What's nice is because we applied the validation rules at the model layer, regardless of whether you're using data annotations or this approach or custom code approach that you write, this will actually apply not just in the edit action that we were in, but let's say, for example, I want to create a new product. And let's say the unit price was zero. Let's say I said unit price is zero. Why didn't that work? Anyway, I'm getting some wrong here. But this would also apply in the create step as well. And so you'll basically, because you're applying to the model layer in one place, at the model or validation in one place, the model layer, everything that uses the model will honor those validation rules for you.
Yeah.
So you've used on the code you've got now an indexer which doesn't really do what indexers do in your product. So you can go, somebody else comes and looks and uses IntelliSense and says, "Oh, I've got an index on the product."
Yeah.
And use that like they expect an indexer to do, but now it does something.
Yeah, what you can do is when you implement an interface in .NET, you can either do explicit or implicit implementation. So this is sort of implicit. I could alternatively say IDEA info.this. And so if someone has a product, it won't show up in IntelliSense. They have to cast it as an IDEA info in order to use it. I didn't want to do it because it sort of if you haven't seen the syntax, it looks a little weird, but I would probably recommend for idea or info scenarios that you do that, because it does, as you say, prevent someone from inadvertently using it with IntelliSense. Quickly, 25 more minutes left. Let's then move on to action filters. So we walked through cron operations, we walked through paging, we looked at validation. With validation, one of the kind of the things I mentioned was by putting the validation logic in the model layer, all your controllers can automatically pick it up when you use the model. It's a good example of some of what I call centralizing logic and kind of this concept we call dry or don't repeat yourself when you're writing your code. Another example of kind of don't repeat yourself concepts is this thing we call action filters, which basically allow you to kind of take what we call cross-cutting concerns and apply it in multiple places. Basically, so it's the easiest way to think about them is they provide a way you can apply reasonable logic pretty easily. So for example, if I wanted to say force authorization to occur, I could just add an attribute called authorize to my index, to my action method, and it would cause this, if it derives the right base class, which it does, will actually execute before my method gets called, and will encapsulate making sure that the users log in before they're allowed to hit this method. Likewise, we have action methods for the filters for things like output caching. And so if I want to say output cache this for a duration of 10 seconds, I can stick that on this method and we apply an automatic caching behavior every time this URL is called. So instead of hitting the database every time, I only hit it every 10 seconds. What's nice is you can create your own custom filters. So you can build these kind of reusable logic modules and reuse them across your app pretty easily. For this app here, I'm going to say authorize, stick it at the controller layer. So you can put it on individual action methods or at the controller. When I do this and hit the page now, you'll notice instead of redisplaying the page, it's sending me off to the login page to log in. I'm not currently registered, so let's just do that. This is the very first time I've used security with this app, so it's going to create automatically the ASP.NET database. Now I'm logging into Scott Goo, if I go /admin, now I have access to that page. If I want to, I go one step further and actually say roles equals and lock it down to a specific security role so that you have to be in a use the standard ASP.NET role-based security model in order to get access to that page. So again, it makes it pretty easy for you to go ahead and add security to your site. You can use this also for things like output caching, logging, a variety of other sort of scenarios. Any questions on that?
If I wanted to override the custom ASP.NET authentication model, what's the base class to inherit from?
Well, there's a couple ways if you want to override authentication. Probably the easiest way is just Google a membership provider. And so if you want to use the existing membership API in ASP.NET, you can just plug in a membership provider and the way you do it. Alternatively, you can bypass membership entirely and just use a raw forms authentication system. So you plug in either one of those layers. So, now we get to unit testing. I mentioned a lot of people here use unit testing. For those of you who don't, a lot of times people often think of unit testing as a way to find bugs. I usually don't think of unit testing that way, although sometimes you will discover bugs by doing unit testing. Oftentimes I kind of see the real value of unit testing being that it enables you to kind of code with more confidence, which sounds very trite. But at a high level, basically, you think about it, you have a project, you have a lot of code in it, you come up with a new feature, you come up with a new scenario, you come up with a design change. How confident are you when you make that change that you haven't broken something in the app? If you don't have any unit tests, oftentimes you have to manually run through a bunch of scenarios. You don't document those scenarios, sometimes you forget a scenario and the customer finds the bug. But even if you document the scenario, running through hundreds of manual tests can sometimes take an hour or two or more. So even a little change, you're sometimes loath to actually make. Get unit tests in place, and they're automated. You can very quickly run your unit tests, and usually within 1 or 2 seconds, know whether or not you broke something or not. And so it just gives you more confidence as you're coding and you work on bigger and bigger apps to make changes and kind of evolve your app. So let's look at some basic unit testing scenarios, and then we'll look at specifically some MVC ones. So if you remember, we created a test project at the beginning when we created our app project, and it has some default tests for our controllers that were added to the project. I'm actually going to start by writing a unit test, not for a controller, but for that product class. So I'm going to create another folder called models in my test project. I'm going to say add new test, and I'm going to create a unit test, and I'm going to call this the product tests class. By default, we had all this junk in there. I don't know why. But they changed that to VS10, so that junk doesn't exist. But basically, the way you've never written unit tests before, this test harness is kind of a standard pattern, is you basically write a test with an attribute called test class, and you have any number of methods you want in it, and you mark them with a test method attribute. And when you run the unit test, VS will load all those things, call those methods, if the methods don't throw an assert, they pass. If they throw an exception or raise an assert, they fail. So fairly simple. And so I'm just going to say test method, public, product name cannot be empty. And so I'm creating this method. It's a fairly verbose name. I'm going to keep it verbose so that when I run my tests, when they fail, I can actually figure out what the heck the test did. If the test name was called test 33, if you end up having to look at the code to figure out what it is. I'm going to use a pattern called AA, or arrange, act, assert. And so I'm going to basically arrange by setting up the context for my test, for the unit of my test. And so I'm going to say products or some admin controller. Controller is equal to new admin controller. I need to make sure I add that namespace so it finds it. I'm going to then act by basically saying string message is equal. I'm going to basically verify that when I call controls, do controller product name, which is that idata or info thing, that this value is not empty. So I'm going to basically say assert. Are not same, and we'll say expect it to be empty, and is not, how am I doing? I want to make sure this is not empty. Cert, I was right the first time, right? Yeah, it's something getting inverted in my head as to which is the appropriate one there. I don't know why I'm actually creating a controller at all. What I want to do is I want to actually say product. It's late in the day. Actually, it's early in the morning my time. Product is equal to new product. And what I want to do is say on the product here, if I haven't set product name, or if I don't product dot product name explicitly, I want to make sure this is going to throw an error. Does that make sense? Not that I thoroughly confuse you. And if I run this now, you'll see that it passed. So all I had to do was basically right-click, hit run test, basically execute all the test methods inside this pass, and if it didn't throw an exception, it basically passed. But the benefit here is if I go into my models, and I'm coding away, and like, oops, I accidentally added a space there. When I rerun my test, when I'm ready to check in, okay, I got a problem, it failed. And I can see, ooh, product name cannot be empty. Huh, there must be a problem there. I can investigate and figure out what the problem is. So that just sort of, by writing those automated tests, makes it really easy for me to find later, if I introduce regression, what the problem is. And again, because it takes only a couple, less than a second to run that test, I can very quickly, as I'm writing code, do that verification. So let's actually, now that we've tested kind of a simple scenario, let's go ahead and test a controller. And so I'm going to create a new test in my controllers folder. I'm going to call this admin controller tests. And these are going to basically, this class is going to encapsulate all of the tests I want to write against my admin controller. And so I'm going to write a task to begin with, which is pretty basic. And I'm going to call it index action returns a view. And what I'm going to do here is basically verify that when my admin controller gets called, that it returns back a view template. I'm going to use the same range act assert. So I'll say var controller equals new admin controller. Let controller's namespace. I'm going to act, which is I'm going to say var result is equal to controller.index. Call that method, passing in a page of 0. And I'm going to say I'm going to expect it to pass back a view result, which is the type of action result of a view. And then I'm going to assert, which is assert.is not null result, expected a view back. So a very simple test here. Notice only 3 lines of code. What's nice about this test is I'm working directly against the controller. I'm not having to fire HTTP at my class. Instead, I'm actually just working directly with the controller layer. I don't need to have a view template, so I'm not going to generate any HTML. Instead, I'm just calling the index method like I would that normal method, like a normal method in a unit test, and then just asserting based on the result. I'm not actually generating the HTML back, which means it's very fast to run this test. Ends up being super easy to actually write my unit tests against my controller layer. Makes sense?
Yeah.
Question?
I'll have a lot of controllers. I want to run the same test against them all. Is there any way of...
Yeah, the question is, let's say you have lots of controllers and you want to run the same test against all. You know, one of the things you can do is you can absolutely have, like, encapsulate this as a method called, like, assert returns view. And they just have lots of sub-methods that call that. So, yeah, you can absolutely structure your test code for maximum reuse. Labor question, yeah?
How about if the admin controller has got HTTP content?
So the question is, what happens if the admin controller requires HTTP content? So let's say, for example, it's working against cookies, or setting or reading cookies explicitly inside the code. One of the things that we support with MVC is this concept called mocking. And so you can use any standard mocking framework with it. And so you can basically fake or simulate the HTTP context and pass it to the controller. And unlike web forms, our controller, we've made our HTTP verbs abstract or virtual, or abstract, so you can basically do easy mocking against it. I'm not going to show that today, but yeah, you can absolutely do mocking against it.
You can do mocking even when you've got attributes on the actions.
Yeah. If you want to, you can do it even at that layer. Yeah, all the attributes use the HTTP context base, which is mockable. Another good question.
With using HTTP mocks, can you verify the routing rules?
Yes, the question is, can you also run unit tests for your routing rules? The answer is yes. You can basically, if you notice in the GlobalSAX, this is marked as static. And so what this means is you can actually, in your unit test, say, populate this route collection with your rules and then write asserts against the actual populated route collection. So it makes it easy to test by default. So anyway, so I got this unit test here. It's cool. I don't actually have to fire up HTTP. Let's go ahead and run it and see what happens. Yeah, it's not going to work. Oh, it failed. Why did it fail? Well, if you actually double click on the exception, you'll see the reason it failed was because in my admin controller, when I call the index method, I'm calling the Northwind service, which is going against the database. And because this test project is my main application project, I didn't actually copy the connection string over, and so it failed when it tried to connect to the database. So I could fix this by copying the connection string over. The downside, though, is it means that every time I run this unit test, I'm hitting the database. That's going to have two big downsides. One is every time I change the database as part of my test, when I simulate like an update, I need to actually write explicit code to clean out the database when it's done. So it just makes setup and teardown logic a little bit more complicated. It also means, though, that I'm actually having to hit the database when I actually run this test, and that's going to be kind of slow. And so if you envision I have 1,000 unit tests for a large project, hitting the database 1,000 times, it's going to take, I don't know how long it'll take. It'll probably take 20 or 30 seconds. And ideally, what I want to do is keep my unit test small so that I can continually be hitting that run test thing, see in a second or two that everything worked, and continue. The longer it takes for my test to run, the less likely I'm going to need to run the tests, which means I get less value out of it. So how can we fix this? We can fix it by taking advantage of a concept called dependency injection. And there's a common term called the Hollywood rule, which is don't call us, we'll call you, which is how they reject people. Which basically means that what we want to do is, on our controller, we want to set it up so that instead of having a hard dependency on Northwind service, which talks to a database, we're going to do an extra layer, which means that the controller can actually be passed its Northwind service dependency, and we can pass either a real version of Northwind service that goes against the database, or what we call a fake implementation of Northwind service, which just works against an in-memory collection of products, which makes it easier for us to test. And so the concept again behind dependency injection is instead of a class like admin controller directly instantiating the objects it needs, it instead provides a way that you can pass them in as arguments. So what does that mean? So let's actually do a couple things. First is we're going to go to this Northwind service class that we created earlier. This has a dependency on our link to SQL object there. I'm going to do a couple things. One is I'm going to do right click. I'm going to say refactor. And I'm going to basically say this Northwind service that has a hard dependency on the database, I want to create a new interface called iNorthwind service that it'll implement, but which I can also have an in-memory version implement as well. And so I'm just going to basically extract its contract into an interface. So what does that mean? So I'm going to say right click, extract interface, I'm going to call it iNorthwind service, add all these methods, hit OK. Mark that as public. Compile, everything's still working just fine. So this iNorthwind service is going to implement the iNorthwind service interface. Then what I'm going to do is go to my admin controller here, and instead of hard coding in Northwind service, I'm going to say this thing actually depends not on the database version, but actually on the iNorthwind service interface. Again, changed it, recompiled, everything just works. Last thing I'm going to do is I'm going to actually remove the new statement here. So instead just leave a field. And I'm then going to create two constructors. One called admin controller, which is the default constructor. And I'm just going to say, like we did before, Northwind is equal to a new Northwind service. This is the database-specific version. And then I'm going to say admin controller, and I'm going to pass it, create a new version, which takes an iNorthwind service as a parameter. And when that happens, I just basically set the Northwind field to that service implementation. By doing this approach, my app will continue to work just like it did before, but I now have an extra constructor here where I can provide my own fake implementation of a Northwind service and have my controller work against it. Makes sense? So what does that mean? So let's create that fake version. To do that, I'll go back to my project. I'm going to say create a folder called fakes. And I'm going to say add a new item. I'm going to create a class. And I'm going to create a fake Northwind service. I'm going to have this implement my Northwind service. And if I wanted to, I could say implement that interface and it would automatically add stub methods for me. In the interest of time, I'm just going to actually add my own implementation here. This differs from the previous Northwind service that we implemented in that it doesn't hit a database. Instead, it just works against an in-memory list of product objects. And so I'm just manually adding stuff and removing stuff from the product this list. But it implements my iNorthwind service, which means I can pass it to my admin controller. My admin controller doesn't know the difference. So it can do all of its operations just like it normally would using the iNorthwind service going against an in-memory database. The benefit then from a testing perspective, so here's where it actually all ties in together, is I can very easily say, create a method called create iNorthwind service fake. And what I'm doing inside this helper method is I basically create a list of in-memory products with some turn data that I specify, and then I just pass it to my Northwind service, and it returns back an iNorthwind service against an in-memory list of products. I can then go into my test here, and I can say, instead of new admin controller going against the database, I can say, instead, use the Northwind fake. Compile, or release compiling, run, it passed. And the reason it passed was it didn't act in the database. In fact, it didn't ever touch a database. Instead, it did. It returned back a view result of page data based on that fake that I passed in. I can then go ahead now and implement any number of other tests that do insert, update, deletes. I can test validation. I can test all those other scenarios, again, without ever having to hit the database. All I have to do is simply stick whatever sample data I want to in here, run the test, and then verify that the controller worked against it and updated that in-memory database, in-memory data correctly. Makes sense? The benefit here is, again, I could write 1,000 tests inside this particular class, run it, probably take less than 2 seconds to actually run through all of them. So it's very easy now for me to write automated tests, have total independence of my database, run them in a fraction of a second. And so now as I make code changes throughout my project, I can make a change with confidence, rerun my tests, and know within a split second whether or not I introduced any bugs. Ends up being a pretty powerful concept for you to go ahead and use. Question? Ah, good question. The question is, what happens if you want to add a column to the product table? What's nice is because I'm not going against the database, the actual persistence of the thing is completely independent of my tests. So I can change the link to SQL definition, but I don't have to actually write, set up, and tear down logic in my tests to recreate the database schema in a different way. Here, we're actually working against the same product object that we were working with link to SQL. It has no notion of persistence. And so this product object, if I added a new column, this would automatically show up in my test. So, if I tear this away, so it ends up being a pretty flexible way. This is what's called manual dependency injection, what I'm showing here, where I'm writing code in order to set this up. We also support what's called IOC containers, or dependency injection containers, which will actually automatically construct your arguments for you. If you don't know what they are, I don't think I'm going to be able to explain it in 60 seconds, but just know that they work great with MVC. And we support all types of IOC containers. I want to close on the testing chapter by doing one other little demo here, or actually talk briefly about test-driven development. So I've shown unit testing. I did it at the end of the project that I was working on, which still provides a lot of value, but one of the things you might have heard people talk about is this concept of TDD, or test-driven development. Test-driven development is not unit testing, or simply unit testing. Test-driven development goes a little bit further and actually says you don't do your unit testing after you've implemented the functionality. Instead, you actually write your unit test first and have it actually spec out the behavior of what you're actually going to do, and then you write the implementation that actually makes the test pass. So it kind of inverts the relationship. Instead of writing functionality and then testing it, you first test the functionality and then implement it. And you might be saying, but does that mean it fails? Because you're testing something that doesn't happen yet. That is part of the mantra, is you actually write a test, verify that it fails, then implement the actual correct functionality, verify the test actually works. It's called often the red-green rule. Red meaning it fails first, then you actually implement it and make it pass. One of the goals again behind TDD is you actually also write the minimum amount of code necessary in order for the test to actually succeed. The goal being there, instead of actually writing reams of code to handle all the scenarios, instead of writing lots of small tests that handle all the different, or that test for all the different scenarios, and then as you're doing that, you actually implement the functionality. That helps you think through all the boundary cases. It's hard sourcing to help you think through the scenarios a little bit better. Potentially cause you to implement the right functionality first. One of the things that we're doing with VS 2010, which is the new release of Visual Studio that's coming out, is making test-driven development work easier from an editor perspective, and it leverages MVC in a nice way. And the whole approach of controllers and view separation with MVC lends itself very well to this kind of approach. So what I'm going to do is I'm using the VS 2010 beta. I'm going to create a new ASP.NET MVC web application with it. The beta itself didn't actually have MVC support in it. Basically, the schedules were off by a few weeks. So actually, the MVC project template today is a separate download on Complex. In beta 2 of VS 2010, it will just be built in. What I've done though is I've created a web app project and I've created a unit test project. What I'm going to show real quick is sort of TDD in action using 2010. So I'm going to create a new test. So rather than implement the products controller by going here and saying add controller, I'm instead going to go to my test project, right click on the controllers, and say new test. And I have a basic unit test. I'm going to say products controller tests. And it's going to create for me a test box. Notice it doesn't have all that junk anymore. The idea behind TDD again is I'm going to write my test first and then write my define my behavior, which means I'm going to write the test that verifies that the products controller does the right thing before I actually write the products controller. What that means is I can say, let's write a test that says index action should return view. So let's use the arrange app assert again. So we say var controller is equal to new products controller. Now, one of the things you'll notice here is this, you know, if you've used VS, well, you've all used probably VS 2008 before, but if you've used VS 2008 before, you'll notice that IntelliSense always tries to help you complete. And so if you're trying to use something that doesn't exist, IntelliSense will say, no, it must, you know, it'll try forcing you into something else, which is sometimes annoying. So one of the things we're doing with 2010 is a mode that you can switch into, kind of which works great for TDD. You basically hit Control-Alt-Space. So instead of trying to force you to something, you can say Control-Alt-Space. Now I can actually say products controller. And notice IntelliSense isn't going all wacky on me. Actually, product controller, not products controller. So it's a little bit helpful. Now, product controller doesn't exist. And so, still going to be a little red squiggly. But what I can do now is I can say, let's act on it. So I'm going to write code against it, even though it doesn't exist. So I can say, controller. Notice, even though it doesn't exist, I do actually have a variable for IntelliSense that I can work against it. It's not going to give me any members, because it doesn't know what it is, but at least it's going to populate my IntelliSense list, which is an improvement from 2008 today. And I can say, we're going to call the index method, which again doesn't exist yet. And we're going to say, we're going to assume it's getting back a view result. Just add that statement there. And then we're going to assert is not null. And we're going to say expected a view. Cool. So we've implemented our test. Now again, if you go to the controllers folder, there is no products controller. So we've written the test before the controller exists. Thinking, this isn't going to work. And you're right. It's going to give me basically, it's going to say, hey, the product controller doesn't exist. What are you doing? What's nice though about in VS 2010 is you now have an option so that if you're using a variable and it doesn't exist, you can create it based on its usage. So in this case here, we're going to say, hey, let's actually generate this control. You know, it knows it's a class based on its usage. And it's going to say, let's just create this. Let's create it in the web app project. Let's stick it in the controllers folder, and let's call it product controller. Oops. And what we should do is name it correctly. So we're going to stick it in the controllers folder. And you'll notice in the background that it just created a products controller class and added it to that folder and named it products controller, which means it'll now work. Likewise, the index method doesn't exist. Let's just generate a stub for it in our thing. Now when I build, it compiles clean, because I now built a products controller with the right signature. Will run. Fails. So we now compile, but as expected, our test fails because the implementation isn't actually done right. Yeah, it doesn't implement it yet. So now I can go to my products controller. I can say, oh, okay, let's derive from the controller base class. This index method will return view result. and let's just say, okay, we're going to return a view. Builds, go back here, rerun our test, run, passes. So it's a simple example of I'm verifying that the index should return a view. I write the test first, it fails. I then implement the behavior based on the test, rerun the test, it passes. And so if you think about as you add, build your app, you can start to use this workflow of create a test class, create lots of test methods on it, start to build up the functionality of your app, be testing it in real time, see it fails, implement it, make sure the test passes. If your test passes when you haven't implemented anything, there's a chance your test is broken. You can basically get into that workflow and start to build up hundreds or thousands of unit tests, depending on the size of your project. These unit tests can automatically, you can run them manually. You can also, with TFS, with Visual Studio, set it up so that every time someone tries to check in a project or check in a code change, all the tests are run against it, and an email report gets sent out whether or not it succeeded or failed. So you can do it on a, not just on the local machine, but you can also set up a build server within your environment. And the benefit there is, again, as your project grows, that you get more developers, and as a project maybe lasts over multiple years, you can have your tests actually codify the spec or behavior of the project and enforce its consistency and accuracy.
Yep.
Yeah, question is, how does this pass when I haven't created the SPX page? Basically, when you, I didn't mention this when you said return view, but the way this actually works is when you call the view helper function, you're actually returning a view result object, which encapsulates saying this is what we want to go ahead and run. It doesn't actually run it yet. It simply says here's actually the result to return. That allows us to chain multiple things together. And the benefit is from a unit testing perspective, it means I can actually verify the functionality of the controller without someone ever, without having to wait for someone to create the HTML page for me.
How am I
going to
test my 404s?
You test your 404s based on your routing rules, actually. So what you do is you test the routing collection, pass them a URL, and say, hey, was it actually handled by my controller? Of course, you really want to test your views. there, we don't have as much automated support. There, typically, what we recommend is something like Watine, or like a test runner that's actually verified, because often you'll have like JavaScript and you want to be able to verify that in kind of a test runner. View testing is the hardest because it tends to be the slowest, and because you're dealing with markup, you know, there's infinite levels of testing you can do for views, like do you test your CSS is correct, do you test it across browsers, and so there it's a little bit harder to write automated tests. That's true for anything, any web technology. So typically what we recommend is test your models, test your controllers, test your routes, and then all automated, and then either use Watine or manual testing sometimes to do your final UI verification.
You can test your view model automated.
Yeah, you test your view model automated, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so that's what you test. You test your controller, your view models, your results, all that you could actually automate completely. I'm going to, since I'm running out of time, I want to quickly just summarize, and then I'll stay around for questions, but I'll make sure let people, because I know some people have trains, I'll make sure I show this slide first. So hopefully in the last 2 hours you saw kind of a quick kind of preview of Basement and MVC. It is a very different way to build apps. Some people find it very natural. Some people say, I'm glad I learned it, but I don't want to use it. Both are perfectly valid feedback options. You know, it does give you some more control over your HTML. It does help with URLs, finds a JavaScript, and with test building TDD. It is, though, like that manual versus automatic transmission. And if you prefer more automatic transmission, which that's what I drive at home, you know, web forms and control-based model gives you a lot of those benefits, gives you a lot of that support. If you're someone who really likes a lot of control, and or who wants to be able to embed testing deeply in their workflow, MVC gives you that. Again, both perfectly valid, both can be perfectly supported going forward. MVC does work with VS 2008 and .NET 3.5 today. It does not require your hoster to install anything, so if you have a .NET 3.5 or 3.5 SP1 enabled hoster, you can actually download MVC and build your app. The hoster can either install MVC or there's a way inside your project you just say, I want to embed a local version of MVC. and you simply FTP it up to your hoster and it'll just work. So it doesn't require them to do anything. And as you kind of saw, it will be a built-in option in 2010. A lot of the TDD and unit testing support coming in use 2010 works great with it, as well as other options. To learn more, go to ASP.NET/NDC. On that page, I quickly go in there, you'll find a Learn tab that will give you lots of information, videos, etc., for how you can learn more. So you go to ASP.NET, go to the NDC page. Then you go to Learn NDC, you can see here a whole bunch of tutorials that are provided. There's a whole bunch of videos you can watch. And then if you want to see my Nerd Dinner series here, as I mentioned, it's about 150 pages. There's an HTML version that you can go visit. This has kind of detailed screenshots for everything, as well as code snippets. There's also a PDF version you can download if you just want the PDF. That's self-contained with everything. This basically covers pretty much everything I covered today in different scenarios, so it's a different approach, but it covers a lot of great stuff. You can also download then some sample applications that we have there. So go to ASP.NET NDC, you can get everything you need. So.